This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Good morning. Welcome to the December 6th, 2011 panel event, Cyberpower. Which nations will emerge as the cyberpowers of the 21st century? This event is part of the Expert Voices Distinguished Speaker Series and is supported by the firm Cyber Campaign. It is my pleasure to introduce Roger Cressy, Senior Vice President at Booz Allen.
Well, thank you very much, and good morning to everyone, and thank you all for coming today. We have a fantastic panel here to talk about an issue that really has never been more important for our nation, for our nation's economic security and our nation's national security. And we've brought together a great group of people who can represent fabulous perspectives on why this issue of cyberpower in the 21st century is so important. Very quickly, I will do introductions, and then we'll get right into the interesting conversation. Frank Schiluffo, to my far right, is the Associate Vice President and Director of the Homeland Policy Institute at George Washington University, where he leads their homeland security effort on policy, research, education, and training. Frank was with the White House for a period of time where I had the pleasure of working with him, where he served as Special Assistant to the President for Homeland Security. Right next to me is Ambassador David Gross, who's a partner at Wiley Rein. Ambassador Gross is one of the nation's foremost experts on international telecommunications, having addressed the United Nations and led U.S. delegations to a series of international bodies on this issue. He now advises foreign companies on non-U.S. countries and opportunities and informs clients regarding a series of different organizations such as OECD, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperative, as well as other international bodies. To my left is Frank Kramer. Frank is a distinguished fellow and member of the Strategic Advisors Group of the Atlantic Council. Frank served in two administrations as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, where I had the pleasure of working with him at the Pentagon. And he is the principal editor and has written several chapters for the book Cyberpower and National Security, and is the author of Cybersecurity and Integrated Government Strategy for Progress. To Frank's left is Dr. Kristen Lord, who is a Vice President and Director of Studies at the Center for New American Security, where she oversees the center's research and serves as one of three members of the center's leadership team. Prior to joining CNAS, Kristen worked at the Brookings Institution and at my alma mater, the George Washington University School of International Affairs. She has been working the issue of cyberpower now intensively for several years. And to her left is Robert Rose, who's the Executive Vice President and Global Head for Strategic Planning and Business Development at Thomson Reuters. In that capacity, he works with the company's executive leadership to develop, identify, and implement strategic business initiatives. He is serving now on the National Security Agency's Cyber Awareness and Response Panel, which provides advice on policy systems and mitigation strategies in support of the government's counterterrorism efforts. He was also the founding member of New York City's Electronic Crimes Task Force, run by the United States Secret Service. So as you can tell, we have a fantastically expert panel here, and we're going to get right into it. So I'm going to start off with Dr. Kramer. Frank, the basic question up front here, what is cyberpower? We've talked about this issue in a variety of different ways in the past, but let's try and define it. You know, how should we think about this concept, and how would you compare and contrast with past balance of power models that we've discussed?
Well, Roger, I think most people understand cyberpower these days instinctively, but if you try to put a definition on it, what I would say is that cyberpower is the ability to use information for other purposes. So you see information being generated worldwide. We have a much greater capacity to make it coherent and to make it available to other uses. So cyber is available in the economic sphere, the so-called flat world that you heard Tom Friedman describe a number of years ago, the global supply chain. Cyber is available in the social sphere and the political sphere. For example, the various orange and other multicolored revolutions, the Arab Spring, depended heavily on cyber. Cyber is available in the military sphere, where we have things like the United States creating and then working on the Cyber Command. We all know there are a lot of issues with respect to cyber, but the real power of cyber is its use and its ubiquitousness. It is available across the entire spectrum of all different kinds of power, and it makes each one of those better, and then it has its own inherent capability. The ability to use information makes you a better competitor.
So let me follow up with Frank Shalhoub on that point. When you think about how Frank Kramer just described cyber power, and we talk about critical infrastructure so much and the importance there. Critical infrastructure is owned and operated by the private sector, 85-90%, depending on what day of the week it is. And one of the things that I think we've struggled with as a government is how do we do a better job bringing the private sector into this issue, recognizing that the priority attached to the use of cyber power has never been greater, and how do we get the private sector involved on that?
Thank you, Roger. And to build on Frank's point, I think very much when you look at the instrumentality of cyber power, human nature doesn't change, but the means to be able to use various forms of power can and does, whether it's political, military, economic, and the like. And Roger, when you opened it up, you said something that I think is absolutely critical, and that is our national security and our economic security, to a large extent, are blurring. And when you look at what makes cyber unique, A, the borderless environment, B, the fact that you can have attacks that are indiscriminate on either military targets or on physical targets that are owned by the private sector. And as you said, 80% of the critical infrastructure, if that's the actual number, is owned and operated by the private sector. The question is, how do we get to the point where it's no longer government lead, private sector follow, but the private sector has an equal seat at the table with the government to devise our policies, since innovation and security are not mutually exclusive. You can and must have both. That said, we all know that that's been a problem. And to my extent, it's time to translate the nouns into verbs. We know that the critical infrastructure is owned by the private sector. We know that they're vulnerable and susceptible to attack. What is it going to take to make that a reality? I've rarely been a proponent of regulations, but I think there are a couple right now that make sense, and one that's in a Senate bill, and that's the SEC reporting requirements. There's very little incentive for a company to report breaches. Competitors will take advantage of it. It invites copycats, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think here that might be one smartly used regulation that could raise the bar and raise it higher.
Now, Frank and I have talked in the past that sometimes the public-private sector dialogue in this has been what we have affectionately called the dialogue of the deaf. And we are doing better. It's been an incremental process, but I think we're doing better as a nation. So I'm going to turn to Bob Rose and ask him if he thinks that's true. Are we starting to listen to each other, and are we doing a better job on this public-private component as we think about cyber power going forward?
Well, I believe, you know, following up on what both Frank Kramer and Frank Shalhoub said, cyber touches all of us every day, military, political, religious, social, intellectual. It affects all aspects of our lives as we become more globalized and interconnected. The problem becomes, and yes, in fact, you know, we are raising the issue. Panels such as this and others that have been going on are certainly getting far more attention. Cyber has become a new domain, just like air, just like sea. It is kind of the domain of our current day lives. The problem that really we're faced with, and it's a significant one, and it's not one that's going to be easily dealt with, but maybe highlighting will, is one of attribution. It is very difficult to determine at times the attribution of where cyber threats are coming from. Going back to the 60s, when we were in the Cold War, the nuclear threat was a significant one because you knew that any kind of action would result in a disproportionate response. The problem today is we don't have the ability to have a disproportionate response because we don't always know where the problem is coming from. Additionally, information sharing is difficult within the private sector because there is people who... companies that may have an interest or until recent SEC kind of requirements to share information about potential compromises were basically stigmatized by their clientele for coming forth with information. You know, their clients say, why should we deal with this firm if they are subject to compromise? And so you had a stigmatization. There is a great disparity today between capability and authorities, and that needs to be rectified also.
So, Kristen, and then David, I want to get your view on this, which is we've talked about different aspects, but there's a cultural factor to this as well. The behavior patterns, how nations approach this issue, their interests, their values, and even the languages, all of which help to shape cyber power. Can you give me a sense of your perspective on how you think these different parts of what we'll call the softer side of this dynamic play such an important role in how nations view cyber power and what they should or should not be doing?
Sure. Thanks, Roger. I think We'll see virtually every country in the world trying to leverage cyberspace in order to improve their economic competitiveness, improve their security, to deliver goods and services better to their societies. But a key differentiator on the value side is likely to be these countries' approach to the question of openness. How are they going to embrace the openness of the internet in order to benefit their societies? To what extent are they vulnerable to the open architecture of the internet? On one hand, the openness, this issue of openness has been a huge boon for innovation and collaboration. It's been the driver for many of the benefits we've seen from the internet. But at the same time, openness has been the seed of our vulnerabilities and has been the source of so many of the cyber attacks, cyber crimes that we've seen so far. And going forward, I think countries are going to try to make a choice. Some of them will try and maintain openness and maintain anonymity in the same anonymity that protects dissidents from dictators. Also, it provides a shield for criminals and spies. Others will try to really clamp down on the openness we've seen in the internet in the past. Security and openness are not in direct competition with each other, but there is a tension there. And the countries that manage to navigate this tension successfully, the ones that manage to maintain security but taking advantage of the openness of the internet, I think are going to be the ones that have the values to succeed going forward.
We have tried to figure out this line domestically in privacy versus security. And I think you're seeing another variation on that when we look at how other nations approach it. David, give me your sense as to how you think this plays together.
Well, I think that it plays together in an extraordinarily important set of relationships. To continue what Christian said, I think probably one of the things that are hard for Americans to understand with regard to these issues is we, as a matter sort of our culture and on our history, are extraordinary people in many respects. And one of those respects is that we, as a society, are very comfortable with sort of Schumpeterian destruction. That is the recognition that the old is the old and the new is the future. We create industries. We are comfortable with constant change in our lives, whether it's cultural change, whether it's economic change. We are a very unusual society in that respect. Most are not, whether it's people who share many of our values, such as Europe, as a group of societies, they are not as comfortable. And you see policies as a result that reflect that lack of comfort. If you're in the developing world, you say, not only are we not comfortable, we're not economically able to do this. We cannot withstand the change, the cost of these changes. So as we look at these issues, we need to be, I think, very sensitive, and it's easy to say we're sensitive, but we need to actually be sensitive to these important cultural differences. That is, the difference between our ability to take the losses, to move forward, to create new industries, versus those who are not. And that reflects itself, as Frank indicated, both in terms of economic changes, societal changes, and ultimately political change.
And I think sometimes we lose sight of what's in our nation's national, what's in our national interest is not necessarily consistent with what's in another nation's interest. And while we want to cooperate, there are some times where competition is just a natural byproduct. One thing I want to talk about very quickly, Frank Shalhoub and I used to deal with the terrorism aspect of all this. And I'm a strong proponent in that cyber terrorism is a misleading term. And it's one that I think has changed the debate over the past few years the wrong way. What we're talking about here is not cyber terrorism. We're talking about something much differently. Terrorists use the internet, but they use it for other purposes. So it's important we understand that this is not a cyber terrorism phenomenon. Frank, you want to comment briefly on that?
Very briefly, Roger. I mean, lexicon matters, and we do use our terminology sometimes very clumsily, which can have major implications from a policy perspective. There's a big difference between cyber terrorism and terrorist use of cyberspace, which is primarily intended to enhance and facilitate their tradecraft. Whether it's for communications purposes, whether it's to fundraise, whether it's to do targeting analysis. But I think the most significant component is the attempt to radicalize and recruit, where it's being used as a think of it as an undergoverned space, where we've had 54 homegrown jihadi cases in the United States since 9/11, a majority of which have occurred since May of 2009. In almost every single case, the internet has played a significant role. The question is, how do we respond? Do we shut it down? To some extent, I feel we should. Or do we keep it open so we can do intelligence exploitation? The truth is it's somewhere in between. We should be pushing it to the margins, making it more difficult. But at the same time, what we're seeing ISAF do with the Taliban in Afghanistan right now, they're pushing back on Twitter to expose the hypocrisy of the Taliban ideology. So it all stems from, not to paraphrase Bill Clinton, but it's not the economy, stupid. Well, it's always the economy. But it's also the ideology, stupid. And until we start actually pushing back on the ideology, exposing it, unpacking it, help facilitate it falling under its own weight, we're going to be playing defense. And that, to me, is the terrorist role. And I might just note, there was an interesting case last week where you saw Jamaat Islamiyah, this is an al-Qaeda-linked terrorist organization, just there were a number of arrests, an FBI-Filipino combined operation that arrested a number of JI members who were phone freakers and hackers, which built on a case in 2009, which the Italian authorities, in conjunction with the FBI. So they're getting into this space, but it's a little, it's not an attack tool alone.
It's an important clarification. So I now want to go down the panel, starting with Bob Rose. And when we talk about cyber events and the impact that it's had on nations and how it's influenced both U.S. policy as well as other actors, you know, which events do you think are the most significant here? And which are the events that we draw the most important lessons from as a nation going forward in terms of how we should be dealing with this concept?
The coverage of cyber events has been ever increasing for the last number of years. You can look at some of the nation-to-nation major events that have taken place. Estonia in 2007, Georgia in 2008, Configure, WikiLeaks, Stuxnet. More recently, you had RSA, which was eye-opening for many. They were certainly considered the gold standard for security, those that have tokens. They were compromised, and it was a significant compromise. Very recently, you had a major aerospace firm who had spent 10 years in the development of an aircraft and billions of dollars, only to find their plans in the hands of a foreign power. Only this week, interestingly, there was what was thought to be initially a problem with a cyber attack. An Illinois pump company turned out to be not a cyber-related incident. So cyber certainly reached the attention of many, and whatever you hear, there is probably far more that Sub Rosa you are not hearing about, that the companies are not broadcasting, not wanting to discuss, because again, about the negative connotation as it relates to their balance sheet, which again is in the process of being changed by the SEC or because of their shareholders. Cyber is certainly an advanced persistent threat in going forward that everybody has to deal with, but the sharing of information is one that is difficult. What events do we learn from this? I think the events are that cyber is here to stay, and that everybody at all levels needs to do a better job with cyber hygiene. The other thing is that people talk about the threat of cyber or what could it mean, and you know, you have one end of the spectrum of people saying that it is not a problem, and the other end saying that, you know, they're going to shut down a major U.S. financial bank or institution or turn off the lights. I think what you have to look at is actually what's taking place and what the capabilities are. And I think our growing, increasing, continued problem today is the theft of intellectual property. That is something that is ongoing. It is happening today as we speak. The amount of our intellectual property going to foreign countries is significant. Over time, it is going to have a great economic impact on our country. It's going, in fact, be transformational is how we move forward. It's going to be a disincentive for companies to want to develop. If it's only going to be found stolen, it will cost jobs. It will cost economy changes. And that is something that is ongoing. You don't have to worry about turning off the lights. You don't have to worry about your bank being shut down, not being at your money. You know, those are subject to, you know, whether this is going to happen. You know, you can look at the difference between capabilities and intent. Well, you know, the capability exists. People argue about intent, what countries are going to be doing, what sector, what sectarian groups are going to be doing. But there's no question, and it's proven every single day, that the threat of the theft of intellectual property is ongoing. It's here. It's with us. And that is something that we need to deal with today.
Kristen, what would you think?
I think one of the things we're going to see going forward is the use of cyber power becoming normalized. So right now, there's a great reluctance to wield cyber power as much as countries could right now. And the reason for this is a good one. It's because we don't fully understand the cascading effects. It's because there's such a shock and awe value of using cyber power right now because it's new and it's frightening and has a magical quality. I think we don't fully understand how the use of cyber power will be interpreted. So there has been a great reluctance to really use cyber power. But over time, this is likely to change. Right now, it is a typical component of the beginning of a military operation that we would bomb a power grid in order to take out the lights. And right now, that's just a standard operating procedure in a military operation. And right now, we actually probably have the capacity to do that with cyber means. But yet, I think right now, if we push were really to come to shove, our military and civilian leaders would still make the choice to do that using kinetic force instead of the cyber means because there's not this comfort. At some point, we are going to cross that Rubicon because it's also crazy at some level, too, right? It's so much less destructive. There's so much... it's so much easier to recreate those to rebuild that civilian infrastructure if it's just taken down with cyber means than it is if it's actually destroyed by kinetic force. But we will cross that Rubicon and it will become a normalized part of wielding national power. And the question for me is just when is that going to happen and how much, what will we have to go through in order for cyber power to become a normalized part of national security policy?
Absolutely. Frank Kramer? Do you think that is that is the way it's going to go, or are there other elements to this that we should be worrying about as well?
I do think that the military will make extensive use of cyber in any conflict situations. We already use electronic warfare, which has a great deal of overlap, and as I think Kristen implied, and I'll say, we need to create the doctrine, and we also need to familiarize the military with actually how to use it. So as we go forward, yes, I do think it'll be a component. But there are other players that will also use cyber, and let me focus a little bit on them. And they all depend on the notion, and I think what we learned from the attacks, as Bob talked about, the key point is that the offense beats the defense. It's very hard to have a perfect defense. It's even hard, to some extent, to have a good defense. We know publicly, if companies like Google and RSA can be penetrated, who else is going to be able to keep the offense out? So if you look at a couple of different kinds of actors in the arena, criminals. Criminals go where the money is, famous Willie Sutton saying, right? Go where the money is. Well, they do it in a couple of ways right now. They steal things like your identity, and there are markets to sell that. They undertake extortion, and they may even start to seek to undertake espionage for purposes of stealing IP and then selling it to the highest bidder. Thinking about how to resolve that problem is one critical issue. Terrorists, as Frank Sulufo talked about, mainly use it for tradecraft. It would be possible to do sort of a pinpoint attack. Now, I'm not suggesting that this devastates a country that it can't be responded to, but it can be used for spectacular kinds of approaches, just a simple shutdown. Shutting something down and keeping it down for a long time, terrorists probably can't do that for a very long time, and I agree with you that they haven't done it yet, so at the issue. But then there's a positive side. There's a series of non-state actors that have made great use of this, and that really comes about in the social arena or the political arena. And again, the Arab Spring is a classic example, as were the revolutions in the former Soviet Union area, where they all use cyber, you know, to coordinate, organize, share thoughts, and generate what turned out to be irresistible momentum to bring down regimes. So I think cyber is an enormously powerful force. It's got a military component, no question about that. It'll enhance military capabilities, I don't think there's any doubt, but I actually think its greatest impact is in the non-military areas.
So Dave, when you hear all that, and I want to turn to the actors themselves now, I think it's time to name names. And we've heard what Bob and Kristen and Frank have said in thinking about cyber power. But when you look at the international landscape, who do you think we need to be paying the most attention to? There's a couple obvious candidates, which I'm sure we're going to talk about. But then there might be some not so obvious candidates. How do you see the landscape, and how would you set it up for the audience?
Well, I think in terms of the international landscape, there are sort of fundamentally two ways you can look at this. One is sort of to continue the conversation we've been having. Who are the state and non-state actors, and where are the non-state actors housed? Where do they come from that have an economic, political, or social impact on the rest of the world, whether it's stealing IP or taking other actions? And I think those are well reported in the press and are pretty well understood. And there are clearly some very bad actors out there. As Bob pointed out, one of the challenges for governments, of course, is that you know where the bad actors are to some degree, but you don't necessarily automatically know, unlike the launch of an ICBM coming from a country, you know that that country is responsible. The fact that an attack comes from a country doesn't, A, mean it's the government of that country, and two, is you don't know whether or not it's really coming from that country at all, whether or not it's just transiting that country. So there are a series of challenges in sort of easily identifying who the bad actors are. Having said that, I think one of the great challenges and opportunities for us will be presented over the next year or so. By that, I mean the challenges in terms of who's doing the right things the right way and who are interested in changing the rules in a non-productive way from an international rules of the road perspective will become known. For example, at the International Telecommunications Union, which is the UN-affiliated entity based in Geneva that has traditionally been where the world has come together to deal with telephony-related issues, they are extraordinarily interested in now becoming a major player in terms of the internet, in terms of internet policy, internet law. There is a 1988 treaty that dealt with international telephony. That treaty will be renegotiated for the first time since 1988 in just about 1 year from now in Dubai, the United Arab Emirates. The world will come together and determine, for example, whether or not this UN-affiliated entity should be playing an active role with regard to internet-related policy issues or not. It already plays some role in terms of cybersecurity in a certain very carefully couched way and a variety of other areas. But the issue of whether or not there should be an active role for the United Nations or the United Nations-affiliated organizations to set those international rules of the road are going to be an extraordinarily important set of issues and challenges for our administration, for our companies, for civil society, and for others. Those governments that seek to have a greater role for the UN and for the ITU are well known. They include places, countries such as Russia, China, many in the Middle East and elsewhere. And in fact, the list of countries that are interested in that is much longer than the list of countries who are not interested, led by the United States. So in terms of answering your question, it's actually a very nuanced answer because it'd be easier to pick one or two major countries and lay the blame or lay the concern with those. It's actually a much more complicated, much more interrelated set of issues, and as a result, a much more challenging foreign policy problem for the country.
I think the multilateral aspect of this is particularly challenging for the reasons you laid out, David, because the normal frameworks that we use in the multilateral world, where it's arms control, state-to-state relations, it gets much more kludgy, if you will, when you're starting to talk about things like cyber power. So spot on. Frank, what do you think? Is that consistent with your view, and how would you look at the international landscape right now in terms of how we prioritize and what we should worry about?
Well, firstly, I think an arms control-like treaty for cyberspace would be a debacle. I mean, you can't do attribution, which totally dispels the whole purpose. And it's not surprising that, I will name names, that the two countries that are advancing this and pushing this most actively, namely Russia and China, are supportive of such an effort because trust but verify, but you can't verify. So I would be very much opposed to that sort of an approach right now, unless we have attribution and other capacities that can be brought to bear. But let me also, while we're talking about this issue, and let's start with Russia and China, which the National Counterintelligence Director at NCIX very, very vocally named as the largest perpetrators of CNE, cyber network exploit, espionage in cyberspace. They have very little disincentive to continue. They continue to do it unfettered. We don't seem to do much in response. So we have to get our arms around some of these issues. And I very much agree with Frank Kramer's point. Offense beats defense. We need to invest in our offensive capacities. On the offensive side, we have to start clarifying the rules of engagement. vis-a-vis Title 10 and Title 50. The greatest breakthrough since 9/11 is where Title 10 meets Title 50. That made the Osama bin Laden raid possible. That made the Awlaki hit possible. We need to look to similar rules of the road in the Silicon domain and cyberspace. And then defensively, we all know the capacity resides at the National Security Agency, but the authority resides at the Department of Homeland Security. How do we bridge that deficit, that gap, in a way that's consistent with their values? So we still have some clarification issues we need to get our arms around. And I just want to make one simple point in terms of incidents that had greatest effect. The Estonian attack by the Russians did have effect. NATO is now coming up with redefining Article 5, the collective defense role. Very significant. And the other one that I think the Rubicon may have in fact been crossed was Stuxnet. This was one of the first examples of where a cyber incident had a very real physical impact. While I will argue till I'm blue that we need to enhance our offensive capabilities, I also want to inoculate ourselves with whatever we may throw into the wild. So I just leave that for some thought.
So I think the NCIX report that talked about state-sponsored espionage and talks very detailed ways about Russia and China, that should be required reading for anybody who cares about this issue, both in the public sector and in the private sector, because it's the first time the United States government is saying in an unclassified document what they've been saying behind closed doors for years. And so this is not just one document, okay, it's out there, let's move on. It has to be a sustained effort by the government working with the private sector to raise awareness on this. One point that Frank mentioned, and then I want to turn to Kristen on how do we stack up vis-a-vis other nations, is that collective defense, the essence of collective defense is an attack on one is an attack on all. So if in cyberspace, if there's an attack, say, on Germany, and Germany asks NATO, invoking Article 5, to respond, is that in the United States' interest? Is that attack on Germany equal to what we feel the attack is, and what should we be doing in response? This is where the multilateral structure that has underpinned our security for decades really gets far more complicated when we're talking about cyber power and talking about how to deal with potential cyber threats across the spectrum. So, Kristen, given what Frank said on this issue, what is your response? How do you think we stack up vis-a-vis other nations as well as non-nation state actors, and what should we be worrying about?
I mean, I think by all accounts, the United States stacks up extremely well in terms of its cyber power, both on the offensive side and even on the defense side. We have many, many vulnerabilities as a society, but we also have a very innovative private sector that's moving very quickly to try and address them. I think the question is more, first, how far ahead are we? And that's not clear. And the second question is, how long will we stay ahead? And that's not clear either. One of the reasons this is very difficult is that it's very, very hard to measure who is ahead because, first, we don't have any clear metrics for making that judgment. And second of all, there's very little transparency. So it's not like military power where you can count the number of tanks a country has or the number of missiles a country has from space or whatnot. It's not like economic power where there are very well accepted means of measuring GDP or exports or things like that. Those metrics don't exist in cyber with respect to cyber power. And then with respect to how long will we stay ahead, even if we could determine who is ahead and by how much, really this comes down to innovation and whether we are going to be able to maintain the workforce and the innovative private sector that's going to give us the tools and the minds we need to stay ahead in the long term. And I think the jury is out.
Frank Kramer, do you agree with that assessment? Do you think that we are going in the right direction with both our offense and our defense? What is the right balance here? And based on what Kristen just said on how we maintain sufficient capability in both, how would you approach it?
I do agree with Kristen. I think she hits all the right points, and I would like to underscore the innovation point. If you think about the IT world or the cyber world and where we were, say, 15 years ago, that's pre-Google, for example. That's certainly pre-Facebook. It's before we really were able to make fundamental use of this capability. There's every reason to believe that with innovation, you could have the same amount of change, different kinds, but the same amount of change over the next 15 years. So we shouldn't think of cyber today as a static kind of phenomenon. It's a dynamic kind of phenomenon, but no one really knows where the change will come about. So that seems to me to really put the premium on structures and capabilities that will allow you to change. One is education. The second is a financial capability that allows you to fund the right kind of research and development and actually bring it into the market or into government use. And a third, and related to both of those, is really the critical issue of people. When you talk now about the cybersecurity side of things, offense does beat defense. I think that's true. But then you can think about the word that's often used, which is called resilience. How do you deal with the problem, even though you know, if you will, an adversary might be inside your networks? How do you limit the damage that can be caused, and how do you respond to come out of that problem? I think the U.S. is really starting to give a lot of attention to that issue. But the critical divide is the fact that we can't just think about the government having resilience, because it's very hard, for example, to run a government without electricity. It's very hard to run a government without telecommunications. You might even want to pay your people, so finance becomes pretty important. So that overlap between the government and the private sector and who has to do what in order to maintain adequate resilience, so if there is a kind of a problem, if there's a loss of trust, for example, if data is corrupted in the banking system, or if there were actually a direct attack, so for example, on critical infrastructure like the grid, how to bring those together. My own view is that this is an area not much akin to the environmental area, say back in 1970, before there were the environmental laws. Everybody knew there was a problem. There was a lot of DDT around, the birds were falling out of the sky, but we didn't have any laws to regulate it. And then we put forward a series of laws that created some requirements for the private sector, but allowed them to figure out how to meet those requirements. So you don't want to freeze them in place, especially in a dynamic industry, but you do want them to do some things that will make the situation better. And a couple people have alluded already to the recent SEC staff guidelines with respect to disclosure on cyber. I would say that's a first step. And I think if the Congress is going to act next year, as some people think they will, they need to act, yes, and I'm strongly in favor of that, but they need to be careful not to cause more harm than they actually provide help.
And the lesson there, the guidance always is, don't take out the sledgehammer. Sometimes a scalpel is what needs to be used. So, Bob Rose, we've talked a little bit about the private sector here, and we've talked about the NCIX report. You know, Ross Perot once famously talked about that giant sucking sound of jobs going into Mexico. Well, there's a different sucking sound we're hearing now, and that's intellectual property being stolen, as you discussed earlier. Financial services sector arguably has been ahead of this better than any other sector, because profit and loss has a wonderful way of focusing the mind in the private sector. And they have done a very good job, I believe, in dealing with this issue, but it's a nonstop challenge. How do you assess the role, what's going on in the private sector right now? Do you think they are doing the right things, and what else do they need? What are the tools do they need in terms of what the government can do to help them in order to stay ahead of this phenomenon?
First, Roger, let me kind of take a step backwards for one moment. We were talking about raising awareness before, and something I had meant to do earlier, but I wanted to thank you and Booz Allen for your longstanding commitment to raising and doing panels such as this and raising awareness and an important topic. So Booz Allen has been, you know, certainly the industry leader in many respects in bringing, you know, these issues to the forefront. There are a couple of gaps that are need to be discussed when you're talking about the private partner, private public partnerships, which I think most people would agree are a necessity. That to kind of embrace the problem is going to require coordination with both. But there are some natural friction that takes place. You have kind of security and national security necessities kind of rubbing against economic motivation. And there's a trade-off between how much money you're going to spend and how much money your competitor is going to spend in order to have security. And is it, in fact, just a cost of doing business? And if you're as good as and safe as your competitor. So you have that friction there. Going back kind of to the telecommunications industry, you saw that the government came in and subsidized that for. So I think, you know, there has to be discussions that should government subsidize to make sure that there's a level playing field, that everybody gets, all corporations get to a some minimum level of security? And I think, you know, that's certainly, you know, a subject of discussion as to. There's also a, when you're talking about economic motivation, you know, I come from my background has been always, until my most recent position with Thomson Reuters, is one been of Wall Street. You know, he who gets there first, you know, frequently benefits. Legacy is, latency is certainly a really an important factor. You know, there are a number of precautions that we can take and that you know, add some latency to transactions, to trading. And, you know, certainly to have one company to be able to execute trades, to be ahead of their first, to get information from that others might have, even fractions of a second before somebody else is a significant competitive advantage. So there has to be a way that people are not penalized for doing the right thing. Now, should that be, you know, government subsidies? Should it be some other things? Should it be minimum levels of competence? I mean, these are subjects of discussion that I think are certainly worthwhile. And then as going back to what Frank and the others had said, there's certainly a disparity or a situation where the government cannot share information many times with the private sector. You know, you hear frequently that if the United States were about to be attacked by, you know, foreign planes and or you know, bombs coming from outside the borders, the military has the authority and the ability to go out and shoot them down at the borders. If we are being attacked, and I'm talking about the commercial sector, not by the government, by hostile digits coming to our border, and in fact they are seen by the NSA, who has the capability of seeing these, they can't do anything about it if, in fact, they're, you know, those are being targeted towards a major bank, financial institution, or corporation. So there is certainly a discrepancy that Frank referred to between authorities and capabilities and how to deal with it. You know, one suggestion, which is certainly not mine and has been long around, but I think certainly worthy of discussion, is the concept of a multi-tiered building in which all players and actors that are involved that have kind of stakeholders are in it, including the FBI with domestic authority and DHS and NSA with capabilities and the ISPs, and each floor is represented there to create a situation of total shared awareness so people see what's happening. And depending on how events play out, and we're talking about at cyber speed, that the relative authority could come in and take over, because you don't know, as people said, going back to my earlier comments and what others referred to, you don't know attribution at times of where things are coming from, and it only is after they start to play out that you know that. So to create regulations at times when you really don't know how things are, and should it be DHS and should it be FBI, or should it be, and DHS has responsibility, but NSA has the capabilities. So, again, many have argued for some time of a shared situational awareness that, again, is actively participated on by private industry and the ISPs is certainly one way to go, because it's hard to determine ahead of time how you're going to react. So, I mean, there is a lot of friction out there in trying to maintain competitiveness and sharing information and sharing classified information and sharing classified signatures so they don't get out there to protect some of the things that are going on. So, I mean, these are ongoing, you know, important issues that are subject to discussion, Roger.
Thanks, Bob. So I'm going to do a Frank and Frank here. So for Frank Shalufo, we've named a couple countries. Now, if you're putting together your top five list here, if it's a, you know, Billboard top five of cyberpower, who else do we worry about? Because we also have a friends and family issue here, too. Espionage is something that our friends practice as well. And so we shouldn't necessarily define this issue just in terms of potential adversaries in the traditional sense.
No, absolutely right, Roger. I mean, if I were to rack and stack Russia, most sophisticated, China, most active. I mean, it stems back to 1999, I believe. What was it? Unrestricted Warfare, where the PLA colonels wrote about, it wasn't necessarily the cyber component, it's how you utilize all these instrumentalities and how the battlefield is blurred between military and civil. So I start there, Iran, is clearly trying to. They've claimed. I don't necessarily think it's accurate, but they claim that they were able to take down a UAV, a stealth UAV, through cyber means. If there is even an iota of accuracy in that, that's very significant. I don't believe there is, but they clearly want, if for no other reason, from a PSYOPs perspective, to be able to demonstrate that they're a player in this space. So at the end of the day, I mean, the Five Eyes community is where we're going to have the strongest relationship, I think, defensively. But ultimately, there are so many other actors in this space, and I start with China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and then you've got all the non-state actors who aren't deterred through conventional means that can exploit whatever technology others have used. Once you put something out there, it's available for others to be able to reverse engineer and exploit. So that's when all the other actors come into play as well.
Frank, you agree? Disagree? Want to add to the list?
Well, let me agree with what was said, but let me add something. There are a couple ways to think about the problem. One is the problem of, if you will, attack in a military context in a way that really makes a difference. To do that, you really have to take down networks. You can't just be thinking about pinpoint activities, because if you knock one thing out, we have lots of redundant capabilities and the like. In order to get to taking down a network, you don't really just operate at the microsecond. You have to do a lot of things in advance. You have to do reconnaissance. You have to get it inside the network and understand it. You have to exfiltrate information. You have to escalate your privileges. It would be a good idea to have some counterfeit hardware and software in there that's doing your bidding, not the owner's bidding. There are only a very few countries that have that capability. The ones Frank mentioned at the top two probably do. And certainly the National Counterintelligence Report, which I think is a very significant report, puts the onus on China, puts the onus on Russia. And that makes its second point, which is we don't now have an attribution problem because we have a government report saying who the problem is. It's China. It's Russia. What we have is a policy problem. What are we going to actually do about it? And one of the things that I think we find is that the government doesn't have all the tools that it might need. It has the capacity to enhance defenses, although, as people have pointed out, the relationships between the Defense Department and the intelligence community, that's the so-called Title 10, Title 50 interface, can be made a lot better. And I've said, and others have said, the private sector government arrangements can be made a lot better. But we could also give the government some greater capabilities. In the counter-terror era, in the counter-WMD area, the government has the capacity to undertake sanctions against a country, sanctions against an individual, sanctions against entities. For my money, one of the things that ought to happen with any legislation with respect to cyber is to give the government that capability to sanction entities, individuals, and the like. It could be entities that actually host the problem and tell them they have to clean things up, or it could be entities that actually do things. The last point I would make is that there were a couple kinds of attacks, and one of the things that you know being in the Defense Department is the best fight is the fight you don't have to have. So people have already talked about the issue of the ITU, and that raises a broader subject. It raises the issue of so-called legal attacks, that is to say things that are not attacks on the battlefield. One of those is forced technology transfer, and we see that a lot in China. Where if you want to play inside China as a competitor, as a business entity, they ask you, so to speak, to provide your source code. That may be good for a couple years, but 3 years down the road, you find you have a competitor. You have lots of issues with respect to that. You have issues of standards. What standard is going to be the new innovative standard? And if someone else has developed it and it's not where the United States companies are, that also undercuts us. So I agree with everything that was said with respect to the problems, but I just like to expand the aperture.
I agree with that 110%, everything you had said there. And I just might underscore one point. The shift from computer network exploit to attack is merely one of intent. In other words, if they can exploit, if they have the desire, they can flip the intent to attack. So the cyber equivalent of intelligence preparation of the battlefield of our critical infrastructure, to me, that is off grounds, and we ought to do something or there's no disincentive for them to continue to do what they do.
Exactly. We're about to shift to questions, but David, very briefly, on the issue of multinational corporations, based on what we've talked about here, what is their role in all of this, and how do they start weighing some of the business and investment decisions in this type of environment?
Well, I think obviously, as was noted at the very beginning of our discussion, that since the vast majority of the infrastructure that is the subject of this discussion is, in fact, in the private sector, those companies are obviously at the front line, either voluntarily or involuntarily, regardless. But that also suggests that it's important for us, as we're having this conversation, I think, not to get too carried away in certain aspects, which is very natural and very easy to do. In particular, for example, as we deal with some of the problems that we've been discussing, including, for example, the extraordinarily important problem of intellectual property and protection of it and so forth, there is a natural automatic reaction to seek government intervention, either by laws or by other means. It is important, it may well be important to take such action. But in so doing, we need to understand some of the costs associated with that, both directly and indirectly. For example, one of the continuing debates we have, and I would say that Secretary Clinton should be really quite proud of the fact that we should be proud of the fact that she has led a real effort in terms of internet freedom and so forth, is to have a dialogue that says that the role of governments in much of this space can be illegitimate. That is, it can be designed to suppress speech, it can be designed to prevent economic advancement, and for other improper means. And so when we create new laws and discuss these new laws, we have to be careful that we're, in fact, recognizing the importance of where governments should act and where governments should not act. And we do not give those who seek to take the other side of these important issues an easy way out of merely explaining that they are drawing the line at a different place than we are, but we're otherwise in agreement. That is an extraordinary, and I think in the future will become an increasingly important source of concern for us, that we have to be clear. As a result, the question is, we don't unilaterally disarm, of course, quite the opposite. And I think we need to be very clever, very thoughtful, very creative in this area. And I think your question presupposes one of the areas where I think we can do a much better job. That is, we as a society and even our government should be encouraging both domestically and globally a more active, more effective set of self-regulation by industry. So far, I think the efforts have been very have been good in intent and poor in execution. That is not to criticize anyone. I think that's the natural outcome of what we've done so far. But if our position is that, in fact, it's very difficult for governments to act in this space without having more harm than good, then we need to look for alternatives, and we need to find ways of giving incentives, appropriate incentives, strong incentives for companies not only and other non-state actors in this space, not only in the United States, but globally. Because one of the, of course, going back to the very beginning of this conversation, it's very ineffective for countries to act in this area by itself. You end up hamstringing or otherwise hurting those that you love the most. And we need to make sure that we try where appropriate and where possible to seek global solutions. So, for example, whether it's the creation of international norms, whether it's the giving incentives, as some have discussed on this panel, for disclosure and therefore for giving economic incentives in terms of the capital markets to give investments to those companies that are doing the right things the right way. Those are some of the paths forward, as compared to trying to just create new laws and regulations that will probably affect those who are law-abiding and be ignored by those who seek not to abide by those laws.
Well, as that wise man Ben Parker once said, with great power comes great responsibility. And in the world of cyber, that is never more true. I'd like to thank the panel for a fascinating and very provocative conversation. Let me thank Frank Schiluffo, David Gross, Frank Kramer, Kristen Lord, and Bob Rose. Thank you all very much, and thank you for attending today.
Thank you for listening to Booz Allen Hamilton's panel discussion on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. To hear this show in its entirety and more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen.